this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We've got a wonderful two guests coming up on the Hagman and Hagman Report, Steve Quayle and Derek Gilbert. Man, this is going to be phenomenal. Joe, can you take this for a second here? I got a wire. Yes,
absolutely. Derek,
a wire problem here.
Derek Gilbert, Steve Quayle from stevequayle.com, and Derek Gilbert, he's talking about his he's on Skywatch TV, The Great Inception. TheGreatInception.com is a groundbreaking new book by Derek P. Gilbert. And Derek's a guest of the show. He's been a guest on the show in the past, as well as his wife. And him and Steve tonight are going to be talking about this book and a number of other things. And folks, go to TheGreatInception.com. There you can get, you can watch the trailers and videos about the book. You can read about the author and about the book. And this is, looks like it's going to be a great read. And Derek Gilbert, he hosts Skywatch TV, a Christian television program that airs on several national networks. And he has a long-running interview podcast, A View from the Bunker, and co-hosts Sci-Friday, a weekly television program that looks at science with news with his wife, author, and analyst, Sharon Gilbert. Derek is a Christian, a husband, and a father, and an author of many novels. And he's been a speaker at a number of Bible Prophecy Conference, including where we met him, Prophecy in the News Conference.
In Orlando.
Him and his wife, yeah. And that was a very fun time.
But by the way, my earpiece just shorted out, so I can't, I'm flying blind. But, two of my favorite people as well, Steve Quayle, stevequayle.com, Derek Gilbert, and Derek and Sharon. I still have a picture in my office of you and I standing with Derek and Sharon. And that is next to, actually, Steve Quayle and Pastor Langford and you and I. So it's kind of an interesting show tonight. Before we get to our guests, and by the way, folks, we're going to be skipping the bottom of the hour network break, and I want to just thank our network for allowing us to do that. Before we get to our guests, I want to tell you about a fantastic meal service that my wife and I are, we're customers, we're clients, we're satisfied customers. You know, we were the other day, we were actually calculating the cost of how much we spend for groceries. I gotta tell you something, right now, through HelloFresh, we actually spend less than $10 per meal using HelloFresh. And this is a meal delivery service, meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. My wife and I have a blast when we cook together. This is one of the few things that we're able to do together. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take, well, about 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned cooks. Believe me, I'm a novice. My wife, however, is a seasoned cook. We balance each other out. They source the freshest of ingredients measured to the exact quantities, so there's no food waste. Never. We have never had any waste at all. They employ 2 full-time registered dietitians on staff, and when you have heart problems and diabetes and things like that, this is important to me, and it should be important to you, because we like to eat clean. We have this service. We have had this service long before they came on with our program. HelloFresh is the finest farm to box company, meal service company, and couch to kitchen company, I suppose. They do so much for so many, and they're proud to be a fork to feel good company, as they put it. And I love that. Folks, the HelloFresh currently offers right now a classic box, a veggie box, and a family box. And you can order 3, 4, or 5 different meals per week. And these are designed for either 2 or 4 people. New recipes are created every week, and they are exciting. They are absolutely delicious. We love them. You can just ask my wife. Email my wife, and she'll tell you. Here's a special offer for all of the listeners right now. Go to HelloFresh.com. That's HelloFresh.com. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com, but you've got to enter our promo code. Our promo code is Hagman30. That's Hagman30. H-A-G-M-A-N-N 30. Hagman30. It's a fantastic deal. Take advantage of this deal. Order today. Go to HelloFresh.com. Enter our promo code Hagman30 for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. Joe, I'm excited about having both Steve and Derek Gilbert on. So
yeah, let's bring Derek on. Derek, welcome back to the Hagman and Hagman Report.
Well, thank you. It's my honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and let's bring on Steve. Steve, it's been a while. Not really, but glad to have you back.
Well, it seems like it, but tonight I get the privilege, and everyone gets the privilege of listening to Derek. Now, his new book, The Great Inception, Satan Psyops from Eden to Armageddon, this is kind of a missing piece that has been, in my opinion, overlooked, and it's one of those things I think, Derek, is like a key to understanding the days ahead. A lot of people ask us why we write this stuff, and it's in order to explain, by understanding the past, the tactics, and the true history of the past, you can see it repeating itself. And I want Derek to get immediately into this because, again, when you're talking about Greek mythology, every single mythology in the world goes back to what Derek's talking about. So, Derek, I'm going to give it to you. And, by the way, you take it for as long. Give it to me when you need a break. But we've got an hour, so I want you to maximize your time. Share with us The Great Inception, Satan Psyops from Eden Armageddon, and what you basically find remarkable. And you're a well-versed guy. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, I've been interviewed, I think, by Derek 18 times, so it's refreshing to be on the other end of the interview. But I think this book is critical. Derek will be one of the keynote speakers at the True Legends Conference in Branson, Missouri, September 15th through the 17th. And the speakers are going to be absolutely laying out, I believe, what God has formulated as the basis of understanding for his people to grasp all this. There's not a day that goes by that a new revelation of evil is not coming on the scene. So God doesn't want his people destroyed for lack of knowledge. Take it away, Derek. You've got complete freedom and liberty.
Well, we're about to demonstrate to folks why my dad used to say, if you ask Derek for the time, he tells you how to build a watch. First, let me just say what an honor this is, because, you know, 15 years ago, when Sharon and I were just getting started in researching this this information and becoming aware of the depth of the enemy's devices and plans against us, I was, you know, we would listen to Steve Quayle on the radio every night and heard Doug Hagman as he began to report on things that were happening around the country that weren't being covered by the major media. And so this is really an honor to have the opportunity to talk tonight. The thing that has really opened my eyes in the last couple of years is actually getting into the Bible and reading the Bible and paying attention to what we read. Sharon and I have been hosting a weekly online Bible study that we call the Gilbert House Fellowship, which actually came out of meetings that we had at that Orlando conference, Doug and Joe. People were coming up to us and saying, we can't find a church that teaches from the Bible. We're hearing about Jesus as an example, Jesus as a life coach, but we're not getting Bible in our churches. And so we decided to just dig into the Bible and spend an hour, a couple hours now every week, just reading and trying to dig a little deeper into the scriptures. Now, neither one of us pretends to be a Bible scholar. We're certainly not claiming that. But our point is that we don't need to be a Bible scholar in order to get more out of the Bible than you do. And speaking for myself, when I read myself and try to keep up with a daily reading plan, it's easy to mentally check out when you get to all the begats and all of the rules and laws in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But everything that's in there is important. And there are details that we tend to overlook if we're not being careful. And the one that caught my eye, which started this process that resulted in the book, The Great Inception, was reading in Exodus about the crossing of the Red Sea. In the book of Exodus, in Exodus 14, we see that God tells Moses to turn around. And I had never heard that before. I've heard the story of the Red Sea crossing, I don't know, 100 times. I mean, I've been going to church since I was a kid in Sunday school. But I'd never heard that part of the story. In Exodus 14, God literally tells Moses, who is leading the Israelites out of Egypt, and they are getting away, that they need to turn around. And what we find when we dig into this is that God specifically engineers a conflict, a confrontation on the shore of the Red Sea for a specific purpose. And it's not just to deliver Israel from the hand of Pharaoh. There's more to it than that. The premise of the book and what this story and a few others that I'll share over the next hour or so reveal is that the Bible is a record. It's a chronicle of a long war between God, Yahweh, the Creator, and the small g gods who rebelled against his authority. We also find that mountains, holy mountains, mounts of assembly, mounts of the congregation, are key to understanding this war. The whole rebellion of these small g gods begins on a mountain, Eden, which is a mountain if you look at Ezekiel 28, and it will end on a mountain, which is God's mount of assembly, his Har Moed in the Hebrew, which is Mount Zion, the Temple Mount. That is where Armageddon will be fought. So this confrontation on the shore of the Red Sea is the first thing that caught my attention, and when I started digging into it, I began to realize there was something more here than what I had been taught before, where God tells Moses and the Israelites, turn back, and camp at a place, and somebody actually sent me the pronunciation of this today, it's Pi-Hiroth, looks like Pi-Hahiroth, which is the way I've been saying it, but I guess in Hebrew it's a Pi-Hiroth, in front of a place called Baal Zephon, and that's what caught my attention. First of all, God telling the Israelites to turn around when they were getting away. And just imagine being the last guy in the line of 2 million Israelites, you know, turning around and seeing the dust from the chariot wheels of the Egyptian army coming behind him. And then getting the order from the front. Moses says, we got to turn around. But the second thing is, what is Baal doing in Egypt? Baal is a Canaanite god. I mean, I'm not a historian, but I knew that much. So I started digging into academic journals and finding papers online published by credentialed scholars of ancient Egyptian history, and find out that these secular scholars know it's not like this is internet conspiracy theory, but there was a period of about 200 years just at the time when the Israelites were in Egypt, that lower Egypt, northern Egypt, was under the control of Semitic-speaking people from Canaan. Now, you can call them Canaanites if you want. Historians call them the Hyksos, which is based on the Egyptian words that mean rulers of foreign lands. So just about the time that Jacob and Joseph and the house of Israel arrive in Goshen, these other people, the Canaanites, the Hyksos, arrive and slowly take over political power in northern Egypt. Egypt was a divided land at that point. You had these Baal-worshipping Semitic people called the Hyksos ruling northern Egypt, and the native Egyptian rulers ruling the southern part of the country. And it was the northern Egyptians, these Hyksos, who were in control during the couple hundred years that the Israelites were in Egypt. They brought with them their culture, they brought with them their architecture, they brought with them their gods, including the king of their pantheon, Baal, the storm god, Hadad. So, what is a Zaphon? This place that God told them to camp. In fact, he told them to camp and face it, while the angel of God then, as a column of fire, separated the Egyptian army, the Hyksos army, from the Israelites. Well, Zaphon just happens to be the name of the mountain that everybody in the ancient world knew was the holy mountain of Baal. It's 500 miles north of the Nile Delta, even farther north of the Red Sea. In fact, it's on the border between Turkey and Syria. It's right on the Mediterranean coast. It's called Jebel al-Akra. It's about a mile high. And everyone knew that that was where the palace of Baal was located. That's where he conducted his business with the other gods of the Canaanite pantheon. So you've got a place that was holy to Baal, a Canaanite god, on the shore of the Red Sea in Egypt, with God telling the Israelites to turn around and camp there and face it all night long. Now remember, they've been in Egypt a long time, a couple hundred years at least, under the rule of these Baal-worshipping Hyksos or Canaanites. Now, why would this be on the shore of the Red Sea? Well, a little more reading, and you find out that Baal in the Canaanite pantheon was not just the king of their gods. He was the storm god, wielded the thunderbolt as his chief weapon, but he was also the god who had mastered the sea. He was the god who had defeated the chaos god of the sea in the Canaanite pantheon. It was called Yam. Yam wanted to be the king of the gods. Baal had to, have it out. Finally defeated him with the help of one of the other gods who made these sacred clubs for Baal to beat the sea into submission. And because of that, Baal was considered the patron god of sailors. Canaanites, who were the premier sailors of the ancient world, and then their descendants, the Phoenicians, for over 1,500 years, worshipped Baal as their patron god, the one who protected them from the chaos of the sea. So now we get the pieces of this puzzle coming together. The Israelites have been under the control of these Baal worshippers for a couple hundred years. The Pharaoh, who knew not Joseph, rose up and began to oppress them. God decided it was time to take them out of Egypt and lead them to the land that he had reserved for himself, which was under the control of the...
That didn't sound good.
Yeah, did we lose Derek?
It sounds like we did. We will.
Boy, that went right through our headsets, Steve. Yeah, I don't know what that was.
Well, can I share something? Why people have got to understand this, please? I think
sure.
I've got instantaneous understanding. When you're exposing the real root of evil, when you're talking about this stuff, who is the prince and power of the air? Well, we know that to be obviously Satan and the fallen angels. What is happening? God is literally stripping the veil off of evil. As this veil is stripped off of evil, God's people are going to be presented with a grand tour of involvement. Just as Derek was speaking about, God wanted them to turn and face the enemy. We're being brought in the place of facing enemy, and I say this, most are being brought in kicking, hollering, and screaming. Let me know when Derek comes back on. This is why it's so critical that people understand. Is Derek back on?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Derek. I'm sorry, I just wanted to fill in. I explained to them when you got disconnected that people can't just sit back and think that we just write this stuff to talk about ancient history, to, you know, basically fill our books with pages of irrelevant stuff. The enemy, literally, and I thank God that this happened tonight, and look, this isn't a Flip Wilson joke. The devil is at war with the people on earth, and God is causing us, Derek, to have to turn and face the enemy. Go ahead, sir. That's just to reallow people to connect with what you're saying.
Well, I appreciate that. And you're right. That's exactly what's going on. There is a long war that's taking place. And what I hope I show in the book is that the enemy takes this really seriously, and so we should as well. But I guess in that vein, I maybe ought to, you know, tighten up a little bit and not take so long to get to a point, just in case this happens again. But I appreciate you reconnecting.
Just go bottom line. If you want to go chapter by chapter, bottom line, and you know, I had to laugh because Tom used to. If you built a watch, he built a watch factory, okay? I'm sorry, I'm chuckling under my breath, but give the bottom line points because this is so critical, Derek. This is like a war manual, and you know, the deal is just go for the points of how the Lord showed you it's relevant because I want people to understand this. This is the battle, and we are experiencing it on the air. We do it every night, but now it's getting worse, and so the whole world's going back to Baal or Baal worship. So will you just go ahead and just let me just share this. Give them both barrels, each chapter, and the conclusion. You know, obviously, got to read the book, but again, that's what we want. Your book will be a war manual, and most people are too disconnected from this. So go ahead, sir. Bottom line, both barrels.
Well, bottom line is that God specifically engineered this confrontation on the shore of the Red Sea with a God who was supposed to be the master of the sea, specifically to deliver a message, not just to the Israelites, but to the nations around Israel, but also in the supernatural realm. God was delivering Israel not just from the hand of Pharaoh, as we're told in the book of Exodus. God was delivering Israel from the hand of Baal. I mean, just picture this. You've got these worshipers who are worshiping the God who mastered the sea, watching the sea part, and the Israelites walking across the dry sea bottom and thinking, Baal has set a trap for the Israelites. And then they got to the other side, and then they followed, and then the waters closed in. Again, this was God delivering a message. My people are free, and we are now coming for you. But in the book, as you mentioned, Steve, the book is divided chapter by chapter into according to the mountains that I think are important in this confrontation. I identified Well, I originally identified seven, but Sharon, my wife, is actually the smart one in the family, and she pointed out that I'd missed one. I mentioned Eden as the original Holy Mountain, and I go into some detail there as to why that's true. Ezekiel 28 tells us that Eden was a holy mountain of God. Adam and Eve were there as part of the divine council. The divine council. This is a sort of a supernatural task force that God set up to carry out His will. Does He need a council? No. But He didn't need me to write this book either, and here I am with a copy in my hand. Here I am, you know, on this radio program. God created these entities with free will, called them angels, if you will, and some of them chose to rebel. One of them in the garden was called the Nakash, translated into English as the serpent. I go into some detail in what the Nakash might have been, what role he may have played in this divine council, and of course what happened to him afterward. Basically, the bottom line is that the upshot of Eden was that the Nakash, the rebel, the serpent, got kicked out of the divine council, got kicked off the holy mountain of God. Adam and Eve got kicked out of the garden, off of the holy mountain of God. And all of history is about God's plan to restore humanity to the place He originally intended us to have, which is the place on the holy mountain of God. And that is where we eventually headed someday. The second mountain in this long-running war of rebellion by these small g gods is, of course, Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon was where the Watchers came down, and according to the Book of Enoch, 200 of them decided to take wives from among human women. They not only mated with human women and created the giants, the men of renown, the Nephilim, they also taught humanity things we weren't supposed to know. Sorcery, witchcraft, the cutting of roots, the casting of enchantments, the making of various incantations and potions and how to make weapons of war and make war, how to deceive and to lie, things like that that we were not supposed to know. And for their trouble, they were cast down to Tartarus. Tartarus is a level below hell, if you can believe that. According to Greek mythology, their old gods, the Titans, who lost a war with their children, the Olympians, led by Zeus, the Titans, led by the god Cronus, were cast down to Tartarus. Tartarus is as far below Hades as the earth is below heaven, according to Greek mythology. But, and, you know, you say, well, Derek, that's mythology. That's a story. Yeah, except that in 2 Peter 2:4, he mentions the angels who sinned and says that God, most English translations say, thrust them down to hell. But the actual verb he uses is tartarao, which means thrust down to Tartarus. Peter was specifically linking the Watchers, the angels who sinned from Genesis 6, with the old gods of Greek mythology, the Titans. That's important. Remember that. I'll come back to that later. The next mountain in this list of holy mountains that figure in this war is the artificial mountain, Babel. And in the book, I make the case that Babel was not, as we've been taught, at Babylon. Why? Nimrod was the second generation after the flood. So, yeah, within a couple hundred years of the flood, they lived a lot longer then. During a period that archaeologists and historians know as the Uruk expansion, this is a city in southeastern Iraq. It was so important to history that we still call that country by the same name today. Uruk, Iraq, it's the same name. 5,000 years later, that's pretty long run for somebody to cast a shadow across history. Nimrod was trying to build, and I go into some detail in The Great Inception as to who I think Nimrod was historically, and this is based on the research of Egyptologist David Roll. He identifies Nimrod as the Sumerian king Enmerkar. Enmerkar is known from the Sumerian king list. He also was second generation after the flood. He was also the king of Uruk. He also expanded his kingdom, as Nimrod did. And archaeologists have found evidence that this city, Uruk, in southeastern Iraq, had set up colonies as far away as southern Turkey, western Iran, the Levant, Lebanon, Syria. They were sending soldiers 400, 500 miles away to conquer other cities all over what is today Syria and southern Turkey, Jordan, and as far away as Israel. This was the world's first empire, and that tracks with what we read about Nimrod in the Bible. Well, what was he trying to do with the Tower of Babel? There's a poem that still survives today, translated within the last couple of hundred years from the ancient, it's in Babylonian, but it recalls an ancient Sumerian poem called Enmerkar and the Lord of Arata. Nobody knows where Arata is for sure, but the point is he was trying to get building materials to do two things. First of all was to build a temple to the goddess Inanna. Inanna, also known as Ishtar, also known as Astarte in the Bible. Venus, Aphrodite, she was the goddess of sex and war. He wanted to build a temple to make her the patron goddess of his city, Uruk, but he also wanted to expand a temple at an ancient city called Eridu. And according to the Sumerian king list, this is the very first city ever built. There was a temple there that was built not long after that city was founded, almost 7,000 years ago, according to what mainstream secular archaeologists believe, and I'll give them that date. 7,000 years ago, a temple to a god called Enki. His temple was called the E-Abzu, which means house of the Abzu. The important thing here is that the Abzu is, in English, what we would call the abyss. It's where we get the word the abyss. Enki was the trickster god. He was the cunning god. He was the god who created these entities called the Apkallu. The Apkallu were the Mesopotamian name for the Watchers, those entities, those fallen angels who came down on Mount Hermon. Enki, the lord of the abyss, was responsible for the Watchers, the Apkallu. This was what Nimrod, Enmerkar, was trying to build and expand. And why? According to this poem, he wanted to make it the abode of the gods. If you want to call that a stargate, okay. What was really happening in the spirit realm? I don't know, but it was important enough that God, Yahweh himself, personally intervened. And he didn't do that very often. That, again, was an attempt to build an artificial holy mountain, an artificial mount of assembly, to be the abode of the gods, to bring it down into the realm where humans lived, and God put a stop to it. The next important mountain, of course, is Mount Sinai. We've already talked about the Red Sea crossing. There was something really interesting that happened about, after Babel, and I should back up just a step. The consequence of this is that God, after Babel, of course, divided the nations. We read about that in Genesis chapter 10. He divided the nations into 70. If you read Genesis 10 and count the number of nations in the table of nations, you'll find that there are 70. Interestingly, the Canaanites believed that their chief god, El, lived on Mount Hermon. That was his mount of assembly, and he lived there with his consort and his 70 sons. They were getting the Al Jazeera version of the Fox News story. In other words, two different versions of the same story. We've got the correct account in the Bible. They've got the other story, the other side, the side that, well, is a psyop, a psychological operation, false information from the enemy to get us to change what we believe by selling us a lie. Now, why is the number 70 important? That appears to be the number of the sons of God, that God, and I'm talking about God Yahweh, because Deuteronomy 32 verses 8 and 9 tell us that when God divided the nations and he gave the nations their inheritance, he divided them according to the number of the sons of God. Now, not all the English translations say that. Most will say the number of the sons of Israel, but the oldest text, including Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament, which is the translation made by Jewish scholars a couple hundred years before Jesus, say number of the sons of God. 70 nations, 70 sons of God, and of course the Canaanites believed that their chief god was the one who had 70 sons living on Mount Hermon.
And so, hey, Mount Derek, let's make it clear for people. That's not talking about the only begotten of the Father. That's talking about supernatural beings that are not in the same category as the Son of God. Just to clarify that so people don't go wild and say, yeah, Gilbert says this, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right. So I think it's really critical that you make that clear, because obviously the scripture says, know ye not that you're gods, and that can mean God's creation, God's possession. But the point I think that you're trying to get people to understand is that this rebellion, and I don't mean to take it away from you, but this rebellion was so great and mighty and involving some of the most, you know, gifted, important, created entities, and right. that's where we're that's what we're talking about now. And let me just share this too and assert this. I don't know if you already talked about this, but not on tonight's show, but in your book, New Jerusalem is 1,400 miles high, 1,400 miles wide, and 1,400 miles in length. Someone's done the calculation that 600,000 stories, billions of people can fit in that, and it's not like God's a slumlord tenant or landlord. I mean, that gives people miles per person. So it's interesting that you talk about a holy mountain and something that sticks up 1,400 miles. I want to make sure I'm making it clear, 1,400 miles into the air. That's one big mountain, the mountain of God, Mount Zion. And I don't know if you even do you compare and contrast that anywhere?
Not in the book. I had not done that. But our friend, the late Patrick Heron, in his book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, I believe is the title of the book, suggested that even though it gives the height and the dimensions around the base, it doesn't say that it's a cube, like a giant Borg cube, that it might in fact be a pyramid. Like, oh, hey, that's an interesting thought. Could be, don't know. But yeah, you're right. It is certainly... would be consistent with a mountain, and ultimately that is, for whatever reason, that seems to be what God prefers, and that's why the enemy is trying to fabricate these artificial, alternate, these phony, these rebellious holy mountains to set up their own, as we read in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, the rebel from Eden wanted to set up his own holy mountain, his own mount of assembly, which does have some interesting prophetic significance when you start looking at the Hebrew. You make a really excellent point, Steve, that I should have learned by now. Sharon has told me often enough, people don't hear what's inside my head. So, yes, these rebellious sons of God, B'nai Elohim, were created beings. Jesus is the creator. He is one with the Father. He existed before all things and spoke the world and the universe and all that's in it into existence.
Right. And one other thing, and then I'm going to turn it right back to you, because you and I have been sharing emails. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm praying, and I pray tonight, Lord, open people's eyes. This is absolutely critical that you understand this. Derek brought up the Greek, quote-unquote, demigod Kronos. But here's what legend says. There was, however, one island in the British Isles in which Kronos was confined and guarded in his sleep by Briareus, for his sleep had been artfully contrived to keep him bound, and there were many demons about him as attendants and servants. Now, here's where it gets interesting. According to Talos, the first century Greek historian, Og, King Og of Bashan, is none other than Kronos. Both Og and Kronos were known as the leader of the Titans. So according to this, Og of Bashan is still alive in stasis somewhere near Britain if he has not been moved. And over the years, Derek, you've listened to so many, I guess, you guys have listened to me, and everybody that's told me who knows about encountering giants coming out of suspended animation stasis. When I sent this to you and you and I talked about it, what I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen, what Derek's writing about is being heralded. And for the record, this isn't a contemporary thing. This was written by Eusebius of Caesarea, and his Preparato Evangelica, or Preparation of the Gospel. And he's one of the church fathers. So go on, Derek. I'm excited, but you talk now. I'll shut up.
No, I hear you. This topic really gets me excited, too, and I began to realize that the Bible is supported by secular history, and you've got the early church fathers writing what was believed by the Greeks about their old gods, and the follow-up book to this, and in fact another book that I'm working on with our friend Josh Peck, we're going to build on this, so I think what's coming out over the next year is some really fascinating stuff. The next mountain, of course, Mount Sinai, was called the Mountain of God, and that's where God led Moses and the Israelites, and of course that's where Moses got the law and where Moses got the plans to build a tabernacle. But there was another interesting incident in there in Exodus 24 where God tells Moses to bring Aaron and the two sons of Aaron, who are the priests, and 70 elders of Israel up Mount Sinai. And I had never heard this before, but in Ezekiel, or rather Exodus 24, beginning at verse 9, then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, those are Aaron's sons, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. They saw the God of Israel. There were under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And this is similar to the description that the Canaanites had for their palace, for their chief god, Baal. Again, an enemy psyop, trying to take what belongs to Yahweh and appropriate it for, you know, take it for their own. Verse 11, and this is interesting. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. He, God, did not lay his hand on the chief people of Israel, the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. God brought Moses, Aaron, and the 70 elders of Israel up the mountain, Mount Sinai, the mountain of God, and they ate a meal with him. This was huge because it was the first time since Eden that humans had joined God face to face on his holy mountain. Why is the number 70 important? Because 70 was the number of the sons of God placed over the nations. These were the gods that were worshipped by the other nations. The national god of Moab, you know, Chemosh, the national god of Ammon, Molech, the national god of the Philistines, Dagon. Those were the 70 B'nai Elohim who rebelled against their creator. And this was God on Mount Sinai with the 70 elders of Israel having a meal with them as a message to the spirit realm. This is what's going to happen. You are going to die like men. That's in Psalm 82, where God is in the midst of the divine council judging these unjust rulers, these unjust gods. You are going to die like men. Humans are going to rejoin me and take your place on my holy mountain. Now, of course, it didn't happen right away because the Israelites, like us in America, us Christians, have a very short memory, and we tend to go back to our old sinful ways. Mount Zaphon, I'd already mentioned, that was the holy mountain of Baal. That was important. In fact, it was so important that the word Zaphon actually became the name or the word for the compass point north in Hebrew. Why? Because Mount Zaphon, Baal's holy mountain, was north of Israel. It's on the border between Turkey and Syria. And that was the direction from which all the invasions of Israel came. When the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians came to invade Israel, they always came from the north. But it also makes some of the prophetic verses that have puzzled us and that scholars have studied and argued about for years really interesting. If you look at Ezekiel 38, you've got that those verses about Gog and the land of Magog and Beth Togarma from the uttermost parts of the north. Again, the Hebrew word for north is the name of Baal's holy mountain. And there are only three places where the Hebrew phrase there in Ezekiel 38:6, Yarikat Zaphon, show up. That's one. The other one, or one of the other two anyway, is in Isaiah 14, which is the very famous passage from the King James, how you are fallen, O Lucifer, son of the morning. The verse shows up down in Isaiah 14, verse 13. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. Those are the loyal angels to God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the Mount of Assembly. There's that phrase again. The Mount of Assembly in the far reaches of the north. Yarikat Zaphon. Some English translations actually say on the remote slopes of Mount Zaphon. So is Gog and Magog, are they coming from Turkey, from this mountain particularly? Or are we looking for a cosmic rebel? Is Gog of Magog actually Baal, who Jesus identified as Satan? I think that's the more likely case. Another holy mountain that was the site of an important confrontation is Mount Carmel. Of course, Baal was being brought into Israel by Ahab and his wife Jezebel. And of course, Elijah performed a massive smackdown there. Note that in that confrontation, it's significant. Baal as the storm god who brought life-giving rain for crops and livestock, that God shut up the heavens for 3 years before the confrontation on Mount Carmel. It was to demonstrate that Baal had no power in Israel except for what Yahweh, God, allowed. And in fact, in the epistle, the letter of James, he clarifies and says it's 3.5 years which is the same period of time that there will be no rain when the two witnesses are witnessing on the streets of Jerusalem in the end times. And then, of course, the most important holy mountain of all is Mount Zion, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and that is where the final battle between good and evil, Armageddon, the ultimate battle, will be fought. I've been taught anyway for years, that the battle would be fought at Megiddo, because Har Megiddon, the Hebrew, means Mount of Megiddo. The problem is, Megiddo is a plain. There's a valley there, but there's no mountain there. But when you and scholars who study ancient languages know this. I am not one. I just happen to have a couple for friends. Tell me that when you transliterate from Hebrew to Greek, sometimes the ayin in the Hebrew gets transferred into a gamma in Greek. So suddenly Har Moed becomes Har Megiddon. Har Moed just means Mount of Assembly. Mount of Assembly. And of course, God's Mount of Assembly is Mount Zion, Jerusalem. So Armageddon will be fought at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem.
Well, I think it's also important that God really commanded the righteous kings to tear down, if you will, the structures and the shrines where the women who went after idolatry literally went to consort with fallen angels, literally have sex with them, and they did it through, I don't want to be gross, but they did it through objects. And I want to share something, since we're talking about Greek mythology. Talos, T-A-L-O-S, who Hatshepsut, if that's the right word, I'm sorry, Hephaestus, that's as close as I can come, molded. He was the first robot. And I don't think people understand that. There were robots, and robots, artificial metal men in Greek mythology that had a force, if you will, a etheric type of blood, which they called the ichor. Now, why is this critical? The life is in the blood. We're now watching headlines of cannibalism, blood sacrifices, the drinking of blood from children. We're talking about robots, cannibalistic robots. We're talking about all this stuff. And somebody says, so why is all this stuff about mythology important? Because it's going to show you what they're doing in the future. Forgive me, what they're now doing and what we used to warn people about was in the future. So Talos, T-A-L-O-S, also a derivation of it is Talon. The fascinating thing is that all through Greek mythology, bringing inanimate objects to life, and the idea, the people will fight over this, but I can tell you firsthand, I've seen it, inanimate objects having a spiritual demonic presence, and that's why people worship talismans and idols and, you know, all this stuff. And and from what I've understood in history, and I got to be blunt, it always has a sexual connotation or overtone. Now, I'm not saying that to titillate or anything. I'm telling people that this is why you're seeing blood sacrifice mixed with perverted sexuality coming out of Hollywood, okay? These people are so flagrant, Derek, that, again, you know, when you talk about a psyop, when it turns from psyop to Satan slop, I think people are going to get it. Because, again, people say to me, and I'm sure you hear it too, how do we get this far? What's happening? You cannot define contemporary events in a classic headline approach. And what we're doing, ladies and gentlemen, is giving you the headlines from, in many cases, 6,000 years or before that were written for this day. Continue, Derek. It's really critical that people understand that. Most people just think, oh, those guys are a bunch of, you know, they're just fake people. People didn't recognize. No, these entities really did what the Book of Enoch said. They really did what the Book of Giants say. And you know what's fascinating? So many people don't even bring the Book of Giants into the common contemporary thought patterns, even though they're Dead Sea Scrolls too. And so the cover-up and cover-over of history is designed for one thing, to deceive us. And I think God's given you the keys. You know, he's given each guy that's going to be speaking, by the way, again, at the conference, the True Legends Conference in Branson, there has never been a conference like this in history from start to finish. There's a lot of Bible scholars. There's a lot of great conferences. They have different topics, but there's never been one like this. And I think it's interesting because you're, you know, you got the blessing because you're dealing with the Titans, the Olympians, and that whole, if you will, Sumerian history. You're the guy that gets to start it off. So, ladies and gentlemen, again, I'd encourage you to go and consider Gen6Conferences.com because you're going to hear Derek in his presentation. He won't be interrupted, but also it takes a massive amount of effort to produce a central thread and theme of what we're all going to be speaking about. And by the way, Derek, I got to say this. I've been getting flooded with DVDs or emails on DVDs for True Legends, the third. And by the way, the name of it's The Holocaust of Giants. We changed the name midstream because as Tom did his investigation, we did our investigation. Basically, it just fit, the title fit better than There Were Giants. Nothing like it's ever been done. The people that are even producing it are going, wow. Now, these are secular people that are producing it. So I want you to know it'll be up on Vimeo for people to download, as our last one does. I just talked to Tim an hour ago, and he said he's hoping for Friday on Vimeo. The shipping on the physical DVDs will start on the 15th or sooner if, you know, the people that produce our DVDs will make some things right for us. That will happen quickly. So I just want to share that because I'm getting emails while we're on the air. So continue, Derek. And again, I want you just to absolutely, if I said to you, Derek Gilbert, what is the most amazing thing that of the majesty of God and the revelation that you came away from that you want to impart to others, what would that be? I wish we had 3 hours for the intro.
Well, I could do 3 hours standing on my head. In fact, I've already done about 5.5 hours worth of presentation, different material from the book. And there are a couple of things. One of the things that blew my mind, getting back to the Titans, but then there's some uplifting good news that that I think really, I think, frosts the cake, and that is our ultimate destiny and how we get back to God's holy mountain. But very quickly, the thing that another mystery in the Bible that drove me to research was the line by God to Abraham when they were joining in a covenant in Genesis 15. Was he told Abraham that his descendants would spend 4 generations in Egypt because the sin of the Amorites, the iniquity of the Amorites, is not yet complete. Okay, all I knew about the Amorites is that they were in the Bible. So I started studying everything I could find, secular researchers, on the Amorites. Found out the Amorites founded Babylon. So all of this occult wickedness, this occult system that is legendary. In fact, the end times one world occult church is Babylon the Great, Mystery Babylon. That all comes from the Amorites. Okay, count that in their corner. Og, the king of Bashan, was an Amorite king. And Moses mentions the dimensions of his bed, by the way, not necessarily because Og was a giant, but because it matched exactly 9 cubits by 4 cubits, the same dimensions exactly as the cultic bed in the temple of Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, where every year during their New Year's festival, he would come down with his consort and have ritual lovemaking to bless the land. Moses was identifying Og as a member of this occult society, this occultic culture that God was driving out of the land before him. Og was of the wickedness of Babylon, the Amorites. What else? Well, the Amorites apparently believed that they were descended from the Titans. Scholars within the last 30 years have found a tablet, an inscription that they translated, and they call it a funerary ritual. No, it was a necromancy ritual. They were trying to communicate with the dead as part of a coronation, the coronation of the last king of the city-state of Ugarit. That was a Canaanite, Amorite kingdom on the coast of what is now Syria. This was about the time of the judges during the Old Testament. And the last king of Ugarit, whose name was Amurapi, the same as Hammurabi the Great of Babylon, who lived about 500 years earlier, in this ritual, it literally says, "We summon you, O Rephaim. We summon you, O Rephaim." Okay, the Rephaim are mentioned in the Bible, Isaiah 14 for one. They're like the spirits of the dead kings of old, the mighty men of renown. But they also summon something called the Council of the Datanu. Well, what were the Datanu? More research found out the Datana was the name of an ancient tribe of Amorites who were the ancestors of the royal houses of Ugarit and of Babylon. Then I found, and this was by accident, stumbled onto, or well, no, I take that back. I was led. I can't take credit. I was led to a piece of research by a secular scholar who goes through the etymology and shows that not only is the Datanu the root word from which the Greeks got the name Titan, okay, that the root word that we see in the Bible as Rephaim was also translated into Greek as a phrase used by their poets who wrote about their cosmology to describe the men of renown who lived during the golden age of Kronos, the demigods who were the ancestors of the Greeks. So the Rephaim equal these men of renown of the golden age, the Nephilim, and the Datanu, from which these royal kings of Ugarit, the royal kings of the Amorite people, traced their ancestry. The Datanu were the Titans, or at least so they believed. So these were the people that God was moving out of Canaan ahead of the Israelites, people who literally, in necromancy rituals, tried to summon the spirits of the old gods of the Greeks, the Titans, Kronos and his bunch, and the spirits of the Nephilim to bless the new king. And here's the other thing, a piece of the puzzle. This last king of Ugarit, his name was Amurapi, and scholars, for whatever reason, think that the root word translated into the Bible as Rephaim means healer, like a doctor of some kind, even though they admit they can't find any example anywhere in history of the Rephaim acting as healers. So they translate his name and the name of his distant cousin Hammurabi the Great as meaning my kinsman is a healer. No, what it means is my kinsmen are the Rephaim. My kinsmen are the Nephilim. My kinsmen are the spirit of these demigods, the product of the sinful relations between the watchers who rebelled against God and human women. Those were the people that God was moving out. Those were the people to whom God said the return of the Israelites from Egypt is timed to the sin of this people, these Amorites. These Amorites who founded Babylon, which has become a byword for occult wickedness, and it will be until the end of history. That blew me away, finding that this is in scholarly research, that these people that God had decreed had to be pushed out of Canaan ahead of the Israelites were literally summoning the spirits of the Titans, the Watchers, and the Nephilim to bless their new king. But the good news is that God has got a plan, and we are going back to his holy mountain someday. This is where we are headed. We are going to be restored to the holy mountain of God and become members once again of the divine council. That's why through the New Testament, have you ever noticed how often the apostles use sonship language, talking about how we are to inherit the kingdom, that we are part of the family, and that we are going. I mean, it's why the parable of the prodigal son is so significant. We are going to be restored to our Father, our Heavenly Father, someday, the faithful in Jesus Christ. And the first two chapters of Hebrews make this really clear. They jump out of the Bible at you when you understand this divine council paradigm and understand that it's all about control of the holy mountains, the holy mountain of God, that the rebel in Isaiah 14 wanted to establish his holy mountain, Mount Zaphon, the holy mountain of Baal, as supreme. That the Canaanites believed that Mount Hermon, where El supposedly ruled with his 70, was key. Do you get that? That's why when Jesus was transfigured on Mount Hermon, that's why that was significant. He was sending a flare into the spirit realm to the rebellious gods, saying, "Here I am, come get some." And then, of course, when he came down the mountain, Luke chapter 10 says he sent out 70 disciples ahead of him into Galilee. There's that number 70 again. It's not a coincidence. And ultimately, we will be restored to God's holy mountain, that new Jerusalem that Steve mentioned earlier. And get this, in Hebrews chapter 2, this is what's going to happen. When in chapter, let's see, Hebrews 2, verse 13, Jesus will announce to the divine assembly, the divine council, Behold, I and the children God has given me. And then if we skip up just a verse. For he who sanctifies, that's God, and those who are sanctified, that's us, all have one source. And of course that is God and Jesus Christ and his sacrifice. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, brothers and sisters. That's you and me, saying, and this is Hebrews 2, verse 12, mark this, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. Do you get that? There's a day coming when Jesus is going to reintroduce us to the divine assembly, the congregation on the mountain of God, and he will sing your praise. If you put your trust in Jesus Christ, in the midst of the congregation, he will sing your praise. That is our destiny, humans. Put your trust in Christ.
What a great thought connecting exercise as well between Steve's work, Derek, your work in current events and how it applies the context. You just drew a great map, mental map, great image of what is yet to come.
Oh,
we got about a minute and a half, brother.
Derek, tell people how they can order your book, because I think this is a primer. Everybody that's going to Branson and wants to know the starting point, which, you know, everything all of us will be talking about, tell them where to get your book.
You can get it at Amazon.com, of course, but if you want to get a special deal, we've got it packaged together with an excellent book by Dr. Michael Heiser called Reversing Hermon, and a hardback edition of the Book of Enoch, plus a couple of other things, a DVD and a CD of interviews and presentations. All of that for a special price at SkywatchTVStore.com. That's SkywatchTVStore.com.
And
wow.
TheGreatInception.com is the website for the book. And
I've got a bunch of video presentations there, so yeah.
Yeah, you do. And trailers as well. Derek Gilbert, Steve Quayle, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It was fantastic. Look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bless you guys. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back with Pastor David Langford after this.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the belly of the beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God particle before CERN actually discovered the God particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, DanielHoldings.com. That's DanielHoldings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to DanielHoldings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way, Everett. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentations. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.